The earth is mute. Go out beyond the world halo, and perceive the diapason roar of the hidden sun, and the thinner arpeggios of stars near and distant, tingling with their own planets and life. No metapsychic humanity? Then call to the ancient in your day, Lilmic race, frail artisans of mental prodigies. But they do not yet exist. Call to the Krondaku, brothers mental despite their fearsome bodies. But they, too, are a race still in embryo, as are the Gi, the Poltroians, and the rude Symbiari. The living universe is incoordinate, mind still chained to matter. The milieu is in its childhood, and blessed diamond mask unborn. There is no one to answer. Elizabeth withdrew. Her eyes beheld her own hands, the diamond ring symbolic of her profession faintly luminous, mocking. Banal mental images lapped and splattered her. The wide-open sub-vocalization of the soldier Billy, brooding over the aging but available charms of a female tavern keeper at a place called Renaya. The other guard, Seng Q, preoccupied with a wager he plans to make upon some contest, the outcome of which might now be modified by the participation of Stein. The captal broadcasting pain waves from a boil in his armpit that is aggravated by the bronze breastplate of his light armor. Stein, seemingly asleep, calmed by his gray torque. Aiken and a woman named Suki, weaving a crude but effective screen over some mental shenanigans. Crane, now deeply in verbal conversation with the anthropologist, discussing the evolution of Tanu society since the opening of the time portal. Elizabeth wove a shield behind which she could mourn, impervious as the diamond of her future patron saint. And when it was finished, she let the bitter sorrow and rage blaze up. She wept for the irony of having fled from loneliness and bereavement, only to encounter it transformed and fresh. Cocooned, wrapped in the fire of loss, she drifted. Her face was as tranquil as that of a statue in the bright light of the Pliocene stars, her mind as inaccessible as they. The ship had no way of knowing that this sun was shortly to enter into a prolonged period of instability, triggered by a nearby supernova. Within 100 years of our arrival, only 1 Conceptus in 30 survived until term. Of those that were born, only about half were normal. We live long, by human standards, but we faced extinction unless the disaster could somehow be ameliorated.
You couldn't simply pack up and leave?
Our ship was a living organism. It died heroically when it brought us to Earth, making an intergalactic leap unprecedented in the history of our race. No, we could not leave. We had to find another solution. The ship and its spouse had chosen Earth for us because of a basic compatibility between our plasma and that of the highest native life form, the Ramapithecines. This enabled us to dominate them with our torque technology.
To enslave them, you mean?
Why use such a pejorative term, Brian? Did your people speak of enslaving chimpanzees or whales? The Ramas are scarcely more sentient. Or would you have had us live in a Stone Age culture? We came here voluntarily in order to follow an ancient lifestyle no longer permissible on the worlds of our galaxy.
But we hardly desire to subsist on roots and berries or live in caves. Perish the thought. So you made the Ramas your servants, and went your merry way until the sun went spotty. And then your genetic engineers found a new use for the Ramas, I presume.
Don't equate our technology with your own, Brian. At this late stage of our racial life, we are very poor engineers, genetic or otherwise. All we were able to do was utilize the Rama females as planting beds for our fertilized ova. It increased our reproductive rate only slightly, and was a lame expedient at best. You can see how the arrival of human time travelers, genetically compatible and virtually immune to the effects of the radiation, would seem providential to us.
Oh, very. Still, you have to admit that the advantages are mostly one-sided.
Are you so certain of that? Recall what kind of misfit human beings make the decision to come to exile. We Tano have a great deal to offer them. Better things than they ever dreamed possible, if they possessed latent metafunctions. And we really ask so little in return.
Something came jabbing Elizabeth.
Stop that.
Jab, jab, jab. Go away.
Jab, jab, jab.
Come out. Help. I've screwed it.
Stop small pecking child mind, Aiken.
Jab.
Vexing insect, swat you, Aiken. Bother someone else.
Jab. Scratch.
Pound.
Damn it, Elizabeth, she's going to bollocks up Stein.
Slowly, Elizabeth turned in her saddle and stared at the rider next to her. Aiken's mind nattered on as she brought into focus a woman form in dark flowing robes. Suki. A tense face with plump cheeks and a button nose. Indigo eyes set too closely together for beauty, glazed with panic. Elizabeth went into her without invitation and grasped the situation in an instant, leaving Aiken and the late-arriving Crayon to watch from outside in helpless impotence. Suki was in the grip of Stein's enraged mind, her sanity almost overwhelmed by the mental power of the wounded man. It was plain what had happened. Suki was a potentially strong latent redactor, and her new silver torque had made the metafunction operant. Egged on by Aiken, she had tested her ability by snooping into Stein, intrigued by the apparent helplessness of the sleeping giant. The young woman had slipped in beneath the low-level neural bath generated by the gray torque, which Crayon had set up to soothe the berserker and block out residual pain from his healing injuries. Under this lid, Suki had seen the pitiful state of Stein's subconscious mind, the old psychic ulcerations, the newly torn rents in his self-esteem, all gurging about in a maelstrom of suppressed violence. The tempter had whispered to Suki, and her innate compassion had responded. She had begun a hopelessly incompetent redact operation on Stein, confident that she could help him. But the brute resident in the pain-filled Viking soul had reared up and attacked her for her meddling. Now both Suki and Stein were caught in a fearsome conflict of psycho-energies. If the antagonism were not promptly resolved, the outcome could be total personality disjunction for Stein and imbecility for the woman. Elizabeth sent one blazing thought to Crayon. She dove in and folded the great wings of her own redactability about the frenzied pair. The young woman mind was flung unceremoniously out to be fielded by Crayon, who let Suki down easily, and then watched with a respect tinged by some other emotion as the mischief was undone. Elizabeth wove restraints, stopped the psychic whirlpool, calmed the heavy pit of fury. She plucked away the jerry-built mind alteration structure confected by Suki with its naive and impudent drainage channels that were too puny for true catharsis. She bore Stein's damaged ego up with loving force while melting the edges of the wounds and pressing the torn parts back so that healing could begin. Even the older psychic abscesses swelled and burst and vented some of their poison through her. Humiliation and rejection diminished. The father monster shrank toward pathetic humanity, and the mother lover lost some of her vesture of fantasy. Stein awakened, looked into Elizabeth's mirror of healing, and cried out.
He rested.
Elizabeth emerged.
The party of riders had come to a halt, crowding closely around Elizabeth and her mount.
She shivered in the sultry evening air. Crayon took his own soft scarlet and white cloak and draped it about her shoulders.
It was magnificent, Elizabeth. None of us, not even Lord Dianket, our greatest, could have done better. They are both safe.
It still isn't complete, she forced herself to say. I can't finalize him. His will is very strong, and he resists. This took all I have now.
Crayon touched the circle of gold about his neck. I can deepen the neural envelope generated by his gray torque. Tonight, when we reach Ronaya, we will be able to do more for him. He will recover in a few days. Stein, who had not once moved during the metapsychic imbroglio, uttered a vast sigh. The two soldiers dismounted and came to adjust his saddle cantle so that it became a high supporting backrest.
There's no danger of his falling now, Crayon said. We'll make him more comfortable later. Now we had better ride on.
Brian demanded. Will somebody tell me what the hell is going on? Lacking a torque, he had missed a great deal of the byplay, which had been telepathic. A stocky man, with tow-colored hair and a vaguely oriental cast to his features, pointed a finger at Aiken Drum.
Ask that one, he started it.
Aiken grinned and twiddled his silver torque. Several white moths appeared suddenly out of the darkness and began orbiting Suki's head in a crazy halo.
Just a little do-goodery gone battery.
Stop that, Crayon commanded.
The moths flew away. The tall Tano addressed Aiken in a tone of veiled menace.
Suki was the agent, but it is obvious that you were the instigator. You amused yourself by placing your friend and this inexperienced woman in mortal danger.
Aiken's gollywog face was unrepentant.
Ah, she seemed strong enough. Nobody forced her to mess with him.
Suki spoke up. Her voice had a ring of stubborn self-righteousness.
I was only trying to help. He was in desperate need. None of the rest of you seemed to care.
Crayon said with asperity, This was not the time or the place to undertake a difficult redaction. Stein would have been treated in good time.
Let me get this straight, said Brian. She tried to alter his mind?
She tried to heal him, Elizabeth said. I suppose Aiken urged her to try out her new metabilities, just as he's been testing his own, but she couldn't handle it.
Stop talking about me as though I were a child, Suki exclaimed. So I bit off more than I could chew, but I meant well.
There was a harsh laugh from the towhead, whose silver torque was nearly concealed by a plaid flannel shirt. He wore heavy twill trousers and woodsman's boots with lug soles.
You meant well. Someday that'll be humanity's epitaph. Even that damn Madame Gudrian meant well when she let people pass into this hell world,
Crayon said. It will be hell for you, only if you make it so, Ramo. Now we must ride on. Elizabeth, if you feel able, would you help Suki to understand something of her new power? At least advise her of the limitations she must accept for now.
I suppose I had better.
Aiken rode close to scowling Suki and patted her shoulder in a brotherly fashion.
There now, sweets. The past mistress of mine, Bendery, will give you a flash course. And then you can work on me. I guarantee not to gobble you alive. We'll have lots of fun while you straighten out the kinks in my poor little evil soul.
Elizabeth's mind reached out and gave Aiken a tweak that made him squawk out loud.
Enough of you, my lad. Go practice working your will on bats or hedgehogs or something.
I'll give you bats,
Aiken promised darkly. He urged his mount forward along the wide track, and the cavalcade began to move once more. Elizabeth opened to Suki, gentling the woman's fear and discomfiture.
I would like to help you, little mind sister. Be at ease, yes?
Bloody-minded, stubborn chagrin, breaking down slowly.
Oh, why not? I did make a terrible hash of it.
All over now. Relax. Let me know you.
Sue Gwen Davies, age 27, born and raised on the last of the Old World orbital colonies. A former juvenile officer full of sturdy empathy and maternal concern for her wretched young clients, the adolescents of the satellite had mounted an insurrection, rebelling against the unnatural life chosen for them by technocratic idealist grandparents, and the milieu had belatedly ruled that the colony must be disbanded. Suki Davies had rejoiced even as her job became redundant. She had no loyalty to the satellite, no philosophical commitment to the experiment that had become obsolete at the very moment that the great intervention commenced. All of Suki's working hours had been spent trying to cope with children who stubbornly resisted the conditioning necessary for life in an orbiting beehive.
When the satellite colony was terminated, Suki came down to Earth, that world seen below for so many aching years. Paradise and peace existed down there, she was sure of it. Earth was Eden. But the real promised land was not to be found on Earth's manicured, busy continents. It was inside the planet. Elizabeth came up short. Suki's mind was moderately intelligent, strong-willed, kindly, latent in high redactability and moderate farsense. But Suki Davies was also firmly convinced that the planet Earth was hollow. Old-fashioned microfiche books, smuggled into the satellite by bored eccentrics and cultists, had introduced her to the ideas of Bender and Giannini and Palmer and Bernard and Sousa. Suki had been enthralled by the notion of a hollow Earth lit by a small central sun, a land of tranquility and invincible goodness, peopled by dwarfish gentlefolk possessing all wisdom and delight. Had not the ancients told tales of subterranean Azar, Avalon, the Elysian Fields, Rhadamansu, and Ultima Thule? Even Buddhist Agata was supposed to be connected by tunnels to the Lama series of Tibet. These dreams seemed not at all outre to Suki, the inhabitant of the inside surface of a 20-kilometer-long spinning cylinder in space. It was logical that Earth be hollow, too. So Suki came down to the old world, where people smiled as she explained what she was looking for. Quite a few helped relieve her of her severance pay as she pursued her quest. There were not, she discovered from expensive personal inspection, mirage-shielded polar apertures leading to the planetary interior, as claimed by some of the old writers. Nor was she able to gain entrance to the underworld via the purported caves in Xizang. Finally, she had gone to Brazil, where one author said there was a tunnel to Agartha located in the remote Serra do Roncador. An old Mercego Indian, sensing an additional gratuity, told her that the tunnel had indeed once existed, but unfortunately it had been closed by an earthquake many thousands of years in the past. Suki had pondered this pronouncement for 3 tearful weeks before concluding that she would surely be able to find the way into the hollow Earth by traveling back into time. She had dressed herself in robes, reflecting her Welsh heritage, and came eagerly to the Pliocene, where, Crayon says, his people founded the paradise. Oh, Suki. Yes, yes, and I, powerful healer, can belong. Crayon's promise. Calm. You can become meta-practitioner of stature, but not instantly. Much, much to learn, dear. Trust, listen, follow, then act.
Want, need to, poor Stein. Other poor ones I can help. Feeling them all around us. Do you feel too?
Elizabeth withdrew from the fidgeting immaturity of Suki's mind and cast about. There was something, completely alien to her experience, that had only glimmered on the fringes of her perception earlier in the evening. What was it? The enigma would not resolve itself into a mental image she could identify. Not yet. And so Elizabeth put the problem aside and returned to the task of instructing Suki. The job was a difficult one that would keep her busy for quite some time, for which, thanks be to God. 8. Bound for the River Rhone. The party rode for 3 more hours into the deepening night and coolness, coming down from the plateau via a steep trail with precarious switchbacks into a forest so thick that the bright light of the stars was blocked out. The 2 soldiers ignited tall flambeaux. One man rode in the van and the other at the rear. They continued their eastward progress while eerie shadows seemed to follow them among the massive gnarled trees.
"Spooky, isn't it?" Aiken inquired of Ramo, who was now riding beside him. "Can't you just imagine these big old cork oaks and chestnuts reaching out to grab you?"
"You talk like an idiot," the other man growled. "I worked in deep forests for 20 years in the BC. Megapod Reserve, ain't nothing spooky about trees."
Aiken was unabashed. So that's why the lumberjack outfit. But if you know trees, you must know that botanists credit them with a primitive self-awareness. Don't you think that the older the plant, the more attuned to the milieu it must be? Just look at these trees along here. Don't tell me they had hardwoods 8-10 meters across on the earth we knew. Why, these babies must be thousands of years older than any tree on old earth. Just reach out to them. Use that silver torque of yours for something besides an Adam's apple warmer. Ancient trees. Evil trees. Can't you feel the bad vibes in this forest? They could resent our coming here. They might sense that in a few million years, humans like us will destroy them. Maybe the trees hate us.
I think, said Ramo, with slow malevolence, that you're trying to make a fool out of me, like you did with Suki. Don't.
Aiken felt himself hoisted up from his saddle. His chained ankles caught him like a victim on a rack. Higher and higher he rose, until he was suspended dangerously close to the branches overhanging the trail.
Hey, it was only a joke, and that hurts!
Ramo began to chuckle, and increased the tension still more. Squeeze. Pummel the glacial mind grip of the Finno-Canadian and make him let go. Let go! Let go! With a crash that made the startled Chalico squeal, Aiken plummeted back into his saddle.
Crayon turned around and said, You have a penchant for cruelty that will have to be curbed, Ramo Hakkinen.
I wonder if all your kind would think so,
inquired the former woodsman in an insolent tone.
Anyhow, you can make this little shit stop bugging me. Tree spooks.
Aiken protested.
A lot of old-time cultures believe that trees have special powers. Didn't they, Brian?
The anthropologist was amused. Oh, yes, tree cults were almost universal in the ancient world of the future. The druids had an entire alphabet for divination based on trees and shrubs. It was apparently a relic of a more widespread tree-centered religion that derived from utmost antiquity. Scandinavians revered a mighty ash tree named Yggdrasil. Greeks dedicated the ash to the sea god Poseidon. Birches were sacred among the Romans. The rowan was a Celtic and Greek symbol of power over death. The hawthorn was associated with sex orgies and the month of May, and so was the apple. Oak trees were cult objects all over pre-literate Europe. For some reason, oaks are especially vulnerable to lightning, so the ancients connected the tree with the thunder god. Greeks, Romans, Gaulish Celts, the British, Teutons, Lithuanians, Slavs, they all held the oak to be sacred. The folklore of almost all European countries featured supernatural beings that dwelt in special trees or haunted the deep woods. The Macedonians had dryads, and the Styrians had vilias, and the Germans had seligen fräulein, and the French had their dame verte. All woodland sprites. Scandinavian people believed in them too, but I've forgotten the name they gave them.
Skogsnefar, said Ramo unexpectedly. My grandfather told me. He was from the Åland Islands, where the people spoke Swedish, full of dumb fairy tales.
Nothing like ethnic pride, chortled Aiken.
And that brought on another row, as the forester lashed out again with his enhanced PK function, and Aiken fought back with his coercive power, trying to make Ramo ram his own forefinger down his throat. At last, Crayon cried,
Omnipotent Tana, enough!
Both men groaned, clutched at their silver torques, and subsided like a pair of whipped schoolboys, silent but unrepentant. Ramo pulled a large silver flask from his pack and began nursing from it. Aiken curled his lip. The forester said,
Hudson's Bay Company, Demerara. 151 proof. Grown-ups only. Eat your heart out.
Elizabeth's cool voice requested. Tell us about the Skogsnefar, Brian. Such an awful name. Were they beautiful?
Oh, yes. Long, flowing hair, seductive bodies, and tails. They were your standard archetypical Amina female menace, luring men into the deep woods in order to sleep with them. And ever after, the poor chaps were completely in the power of the elf women. A man who tried to leave would sicken and die, or else go mad. Victims of the Skogsnefar
were written about well into the 20th century in Sweden.
Suki said, Welsh folklore had such creatures too, but they lived in lakes, not forests. They were called the Gwagreth Anun, and they came up to dance on the water in the misty moonlight and lured travelers into their underwater palaces.
It's a common folkloric theme, Brian said. The symbolism is easily grasped. Still, one has to feel a bit sorry for the poor male elves. They seem to have missed out on a lot of good, dirty fun.
Most of the humans laughed, including the guards.
Are there any parallel legends among your people, Crayon? The anthropologist asked. Or didn't your culture produce tales of enchantment? There was no need, the Tano replied, in a repressive tone.
An odd notion occurred to Elizabeth. She attempted to slide a microprobe through Crayon's screen without triggering his awareness.
Ah, Elizabeth, don't. These petty aggressions games, idle scrabblings for superiority.
Innocent incredulity, scorn-colored taunt.
Nonsense. I am old, tired, civilized of goodwill to you and yours, even ultimately crushable. But others my kind not. Beware, Elizabeth. Reject not Tanu lightly. Remember Puffin.
Puffin?
Child poem your folk from human educator among us long deceased. Lonely bird, only one of a kind, ate fishes, bewailed solitude. Friendship proffered by fishes if bird refrained devouring. Deal accepted, meal habits changed. Fishes only game in town for Puffin.
As you, Tanu, are for me.
Affirm, Eliza Puffinbeth. She burst out laughing, and Brian and the other humans looked at her in blank astonishment.
Somebody, Aiken remarked, has been whispering behind our minds. Are you going to let us in on the joke, lovey?
The joke's on me, Aiken, Elizabeth turned to Crayon.
We'll have a truce. For now.
The exotic man inclined his head.
Then permit me to change the subject. We are approaching the bottomlands of the river, where we'll have our night's rest in the city of Vernaya. Tomorrow, we shall resume our journey in a more agreeable fashion, by boat. We should arrive in the capital city of Moriah in less than 5 days, if the winds are right.
Sailboats on a turbulent river like the Rhone? Brian said, aghast. Or is it calmer here in the Pliocene?
You'll have to judge for yourself, of course. However, our boats are quite different from those you may have been accustomed to. We Tano are not fond of water travel. But with the coming of humanity, safe and efficient boats were designed and river commerce became extensive. We now use boats not only for passenger travel, but also to ship vital commodities from the north, especially from Fenaya and the Garaya in the area you call Brittany, to the southern regions, where the climate is more to our taste.
I've brought a sailboat with me, the anthropologist said. Will I be permitted to use it? I'd like to visit your Fenaya and Garaya.
As you'll see, upstream travel is generally not feasible. We rely on caravans for that, using either calicos or larger beasts of burden called helads, a species of short-necked giraffe. In the course of your researches, you will doubtless make visits to several of our population centers.
Without a torque on him? Ramo interjected. You'd trust him?
Crayon laughed. We have something he wants.
Brian flinched, but he knew better than to rise to the bait. He only said,
These vital commodities you ship, I suppose they include mostly foodstuffs?
To some extent. But this many-colored land is literally overflowing with meat and drink for the taking.
Minerals, then. Gold and silver, copper and tin, iron.
Not iron. It is unnecessary in our rather simple techno-economy. The Tanu worlds have traditionally relied on varieties of unbreakable glass in those applications where humanity utilized iron. It is interesting that in recent years you too have come to appreciate the versatile material.
Vitrador, yes, Still, your fighting men seem to prefer the traditional bronze in their armor and weapons.
Crane laughed quietly. In the earliest days of the time portal, it was considered wise to restrict human warriors in that way. Now, when the restriction has become obsolete, humans continue to cling to the metal. We permit a bronze technology to flourish among your people where it does not conflict with our own needs. We Tanu are a tolerant race. We were self-sufficient before humans began to arrive, and we are by no means dependent upon humanity for slave labor.
Elizabeth's thought loomed large, other than reproductive enslavement.
Since the tedious and difficult work such as mining and agriculture and comfort maintenance is undertaken by Ramas in all but the most isolated settlements.
These Ramas, Aiken broke in, how come there weren't any back at the castle to do the dirty work?
They have a certain psychic fragility, and require a tranquil environment if they are to function with minimal supervision. At Castle Gateway there is inevitable stress.
Remo gave a derisive grunt. Brian asked,
how are the creatures controlled?
They wear a much simplified modification of the Grey Torque. But you must not press me to explain these matters now. Please wait until later, in Moriah.
They rode into an area where the trees were not so thickly clustered, among giant crags at the base of a sparsely forested ridge. Up where the crest met the starry sky was a glow of colored light.
Is that the town up there? Suki inquired.
Can't be, Ramo said contemptuously. Look at the thing move.
They reined in their chalicos and watched the glow resolve into a thin skein of luminescence that twisted in and out of the distant silhouettes of trees at considerable speed. The light was a blend of many hues, basically golden but with knots that flared blue, green, red, and even purple, in a panoply of sparkling commotion, wild and urgent.
Ah, Crayon said. The hunt. If they come this way, you'll see a fine sight.
It looks like a giant rainbow glowworm racing up there, Suki breathed. How lovely.
The Tanu at play? Brian asked.
Suki uttered a disappointed cry.
Oh, they've gone over the ridge. What a shame. Tell us what the hunt is, Lord Crayon.
The exotic man's face was grave in the starlight.
One of the great traditions of our people. You'll see it again, many times. I'll let you discover for yourselves what it is.
And if we're good, Aiken put in impudently, do we get to join in?
Possibly, Crayon replied. It is not to every human's taste, nor even to every Tanu's, but you. Yes, I think perhaps the hunt would appeal to your particular sporting instinct, Aikendrum.
And for an instant, the healer's emotional tone was plain for Elizabeth to read. Disgust, mingled with an age-old sense of despair. 9. Richard saw flames. They were moving toward him, or he was moving toward them, and they were vivid orange and resin smoky, rising tall into a wavering queue in the nearly windless dark. He saw that it was a pile of burning brush the size of a small hut, crackling and hissing but throwing no sparks, seeming to draw abreast of him, pass him by and recede, disappearing at last behind a grove of black trees that had crept up unseen in the night, but now stood backlighted by the bonfire's glow. It hurt his neck to look back. He let his head loll forward. There was something bulky just in front of him that had long hair and moved rhythmically. It was very strange. He himself was rocking, firmly supported in some kind of seat that held him upright. His legs were thrust forward at an angle, the calves resting on unseen supports, feet braced against wide treads. His arms, clad in the familiar sleeves of a master spacer's coverall, rested in his lap. A funny kind of starship, he mused, with a hairy control console. And the environmental must be on the fritz because the temperature was nearly 30
and there was dust in the air and a peculiar smell. Trees? And a bonfire? He looked around and saw stars. Not the proper colored stars you see in deep space, but little twinkling specks. Far away, in the black below the starry bowl, was another small exclamation point of fire.
Richard, are you awake? Would you like some water?
Well, would you look at who was flying the right-hand seat of this crate? None other than the old bone hunter. Would have thought he was too creco to qualify. But then you don't need much finesse to fly on the ground.
Richard, if I pass you the canteen, can you hold on to it?
Smells of animals, pungent vegetation, leather, sounds of creaking harness, brisk clumping feet, huffing exhalations, something yipping in the distance, and the voice of the persistent old man beside him.
Don't want water, said Richard.
Amory said you'd need it when you woke up. You're dehydrated. Come on, son.
He took a closer look at Claude there in the darkness. The old man's figure was illuminated by starlight. He was astride a huge, horse-like creature that was loping easily along. Darndest thing, he was riding one, too. There were the reins draped over the pommel of a saddle right in front of him below the hairy control console, neck of the critter, and it was trotting straight and level without any guidance at all. Richard tried to pull his feet up and discovered that his ankles were fastened somehow to the stirrups, and he wasn't wearing his sea boots, and someone had exchanged his opera costume for the spacer's coverall, with the four stripes on the sleeves that he had stuffed into the bottom of his pack, and he had an Imperial Grand Champion hangover.
Claude, he groaned, you got any booze?
You can't have any, boy, not until the drug Amory shot into you wears off. Here, take the water.
Richard had to lean far out to grasp the canteen, and the starry sky lurched. If his ankles had not been fastened, he would have fallen from the saddle.
Jesus, I've been chewed up and spit out, Claude. Where the hell are we, and what's this thing I'm riding?
We're about 4 hours out from the castle, riding due north and parallel to the Saône River.
As near as I can judge, you're riding a nice large specimen of Chelicotherium goldfusi, which the locals call a chelico, not a calico.
The beasts travel a pretty fair clip here on the plateau, maybe 15 or 16 kilometers an hour. But we lost time fording creeks around a little swamp, so I guess we might be 30 kilometers above Lyon. If there was a Lyon.
Richard cursed.
Bound where, for God's sake?
Some Pliocene metropolis called Phanaea. From what they told us, it's on the Proto-Rhine, about in the position of Freiburg. We get there in 6 days.
Richard drank some of the water and discovered he was very thirsty. He could remember nothing beyond the welcoming smile on Ippon's face as he followed her into the dazzling inner chamber of the castle. He tried to marshal his wits, but all he could rake up were tattered dreams in which his brother and sister seemed to urge him to get up, or he'd be late for school. And the penalty for that would be cruising the gray limbo forever and ever, searching for a lost planet where Ippon would be waiting. After a while, he asked,
"What happened to me?"
"We aren't sure," Claude temporized. "You know, don't you, that there were exotics in the castle?"
"I remember a tall woman," Richard muttered. "I think she did something to me."
"Whatever it was, you were out for hours. Amory got you semi-conscious so that you'd be able to move out with the rest of us in the caravan. We thought you'd prefer that to being left behind alone."
"Christ, yes."
Richard took slow swallows of water, leaned back, and watched the sky for a long time. There were a hell of a lot of stars, and pearly streaks of luminescent cloud toward the zenith. As the caravan began descending a long downhill slope, he could see that he and the old man were near the tail end of a long double file of riders. Now that his eyes worked properly again, he discerned other dark shapes coursing along both sides of the column with awkward, humping strides.
What the devil are those things out there?
Amphicyons riding herd on us. We have a guard of 5 soldiers, too, but they hardly ever bother to check up. There are 2 bringing up the rear and 3 in front with the exalted lady.
The who?
Ipone herself. She comes from Fenaya. These exotics, they're called Tanu, by the way, seem to have widely scattered settlements, each with a central urban area and satellite supporting plantations. My guess is that humans function as slaves or serfs, with some exceptional types enjoying special privileges. Evidently, the Tanu cities take turns collecting a week's worth of time travelers at Castle Gateway, minus the specials who get siphoned off to the capital, and the unlucky ones who are killed trying to escape.
We aren't special, I take it.
Just part of the grunt pack. Amory and Felice are in the caravan, too. But the 4 other greenies were sifted out and sent south to the big time. Group Green seems to have been unusual in having so many taken. There were only 2 other people sent to the capital from the rest of the week's contingent.
As they rode along, the old man told Richard as much as he could about the day's events and the presumed fate of Aiken, Elizabeth, Brian, and Stein. He also summarized Valdemar's little speech and reluctantly told of the future in store for the women of the party. The ex-spacer ventured a few questions, then fell silent. Too bad about the nun going to an exotic harem. She'd been decent to him. On the other hand, that stuck-up ice queen of an Elizabeth needed a good stoking. And Felice, that sly little bitch. Richard had offered her a harmless little suggestion back at the auberge, and she'd sent him up like a holiday firework. Damn teasing little snatch. He hoped the exotics had peckers like baseball bats. It would serve her right. Might even make a real woman out of her. The caravan moved steadily down the incline, heading a little east of north now, and coming closer to the river. The beacon fire was their landmark. Claude had told him that similar fires were spaced about 2 kilometers apart all the way from the castle. A scouting party must be riding in advance of the caravan along the track, torching the waiting piles of brush if all was well.
"I think I see a building down there," Claude said. "Maybe it's the place where we stop for a break."
Richard sure as hell hoped so. He had drunk too much water.
From the head of the column came the silvery notes of a horn sounding a 3-toned call. This was echoed distantly. After a few minutes had passed, a dozen or so tiny pinpricks of fire emerged from the vicinity of the downslope bonfire and approached the caravan in a sinuous line, riders carrying torches coming to escort them. By the time the groups converged, Claude and Richard could see that the last beacon fire burned outside of a walled enclosure resembling an ancient American plains fort. It stood on a bluff above a tree-crowded watercourse that must drain into the Saône. The caravan halted momentarily, and Lady Ipone and Valdemar went forward to greet the escort party. In the torchlight, Richard unconcernedly admired the stately Tanu woman, who was riding a white calicothere of exceptional size and wearing a dark blue hooded cloak that floated behind her. After a moment's conference, 2 of the soldiers from the fort rode off to one side and in some manner called in the pack of amphicyons. The bear dogs were led away on a side path, while the rest of the escort fell in beside the caravan for the last part of the journey. A gate in the palisade opened, and they rode inside 2 by 2. Then, in what was to become a familiar procedure, the prisoners had their mounts tethered to posts in front of double troughs of feed and water. At the left of each chalico was a dismounting block. After the soldiers unlocked their chains, the muscle-sore travelers descended and gathered in an untidy group, while Valdemar addressed them once again.
"All you travelers! We'll rest here for 1 hour.
Then go on until early morning another 8 hours.
Everybody groaned.
Latrines in the small building behind you. Get your food and drink in the bigger building next door. Anybody sick or got a complaint, see me. Be ready to remount when you hear the horn. Nobody comes into the area beyond the hitching rail. That's all.
Ipone, who was still on Chalico back, guided her beast delicately through the throng until she loomed over Richard.
I'm glad to see you're recovering. He gave her a quizzical look.
I'm just dandy, and it's nice to know you're a lady who cares about the health of her livestock.
She threw her head back and laughed, cascades of sound like the deep strumming of a harp. Her partially hidden hair gleamed in the torchlight.
It really is too bad about you, she said. You've certainly got more spirit than that silly medievalist.
She turned her animal away, rode to the opposite side of the compound, and was helped out of the saddle by obsequious men in white tunics.
What was that all about? Inquired Amory, who had come up with Felice.
Richard glowered.
How the fuck should I know?
He went tottering off toward the latrine. Felice watched him go.
Are all your patients this grateful?
The nun laughed. He's coming along just fine. You know they're on the mend when they bite your head off.
He's nothing but a stupid weakling.
I think you're wrong about that, Amory said. But Felice only snorted and went off to the mess hall. Later, when the two women and Claude were eating cheese and cold meat and maize bread, Richard came and apologized.
Think nothing of it, the nun said. Sit down with us. We've got something to talk over with you.
Richard's eyes narrowed.
Yeah?
Claude said softly.
Felice has a plan for escape, but there are problems.
No shit, the pirate guffawed.
The little ring hockey player took Richard's hand and squeezed. His eyes bulged and he pressed his lips together.
Less noise, Felice said. The problem isn't in the escape itself, but in the aftermath. They've taken our maps and compasses. Claude has a general knowledge of this part of Europe from his paleontology studies more than 100 years ago. But that won't help us if we can't orient ourselves while we're on the run.
Can you help us? Did you study the large-scale map of Pliocene France when we were back at the auberge?
She dropped his hand, and Richard stared at the whitened flesh, then threw her a glance of pure venom.
Hell no! I figured there'd be plenty of time for that once we arrived. I brought a self-compensating compass, a computer sextant, all the charts I'd need, but I suppose all the stuff was confiscated. The only route I looked at was the one west to the Atlantic, to Bordeaux.
Felice grunted in disgust. Claude persisted in a peaceable tone.
We know you must be experienced in navigation, son. There's got to be some way we can orient ourselves. Can you locate the Pliocene Pole Star for us? That would be a big help.
So would a frigate of the Fleet Air Arm, Richard grumbled. Or Robin Hood and his merry men.
Felice reached out for him again, and he dodged back hastily.
Can you do it, Richard? She asked. Or are those stripes on your sleeves for good conduct?
This isn't my home planet, Dikey doll. And the noctilucent clouds don't make the job any easier.
Lots of volcanism, Claude said. Dust in the upper atmosphere. But the moon has set and there aren't any ordinary clouds. Do you think you'd be able to get a fix as the glowing patches come and go?
I might, Richard muttered. But why the hell I should bother beats me. What I want to know is what happened to my pirate outfit. Who put this coverall on me?
It was there, Felice said sweetly, and you needed it. Badly. So we obliged. Anything to help out a friend.
Claude hurried to say, You got all messed up in some fight you were in back at the castle. I just cleaned you up a bit and washed your other clothes. They're hanging on the back of your saddle. Should be dry by now.
Richard looked suspiciously at the smirking Felice, then thanked the old man.
But a fight? Had he been in a fight? And who had been laughing at him with lofty contempt? A woman with drowning pool eyes. But not Felice.
Amory said,
Please, try for the Polestar if you feel well enough to manage it. We only have one more night of travel on the High North Road. Then we'll be angling off every which way and traveling in the daytime. Richard, it's important.
Okay, okay, he grouched. I don't suppose any of you earthworms knows the latitude of Lyon.
About 45 north, I think, said Claude. Around the same as my boyhood home in Oregon, anyhow, from the way I remember the sky above the auberge. Too bad we don't have Stein. He'd know.
A rough guess is good enough, Richard said.
The nun lifted her head. The sound of a horn came from outside in the fort's yard.
Well, here we go again, group. Good luck, Richard.
Mega thanks, sister. If we follow any escape plan this kid dreams up, we're gonna need it.
They rode on through the night, traveling from beacon to beacon along the plateau trail, with the river valley at their right, and the scattered small volcanoes of the La Magna, giving an occasional ruby pulse in the southwest, constellations totally unfamiliar to the Earth natives of the 22nd century, crowded the sky of exile. Many of those stars were the same ones that would be visible in the planet's future, but their differing galactic orbits had twisted the familiar star patterns all out of recognition. There were stars in the Pliocene sky that were destined to die before the time of the galactic milieu. Others that milieu people would know were at this time still dark in their dust cloud wombs. Richard viewed the Pliocene heavens with nonchalance. He'd seen an awful lot of different skies, given plenty of time and a fixed base for observation. Finding the local Polaris would be a snap, even with eyeball instrumentation alone. It was only the fact that they were moving on animal back and the need for a quick fix that made the thing a bit tricky. Now, if the old fossil flicker was right about the rough latitude, and if they were on a near northerly course of this trail as Claude thought they'd have to be, given the lay of the land, then the Polestar should be about halfway between the horizon and the zenith somewhere in there. He had picked up a couple of stiff twigs from the litter back at the fort and now bound them together into a cross sight with a hair from his mount's mane. Each stalk was twice as long as his hand. He hoped the field wouldn't be too limited. Adjusting his position in the saddle to minimize the effect of the Chalico's rocking gait, he memorized the constellations that had to be roughly circumpolar. Then he held the cross sight at arm's length and aligned the vertical axis with the straight track ahead, analog to upright Chalico ears, and centered it on a likely star he had tentatively selected. He carefully noted the positions of five other bright stars within the quadrants of his sight, and then relaxed. 3 hours from now, when planetary rotation had made those six stars seem to change position slightly, he'd take another sighting. His near-photographic memory would do an angular comparison within the field of the cross-sight, and with luck, he would be able to discern the imaginary hub in the sky about which all those stars were turning. The hub would be the pole. It might or might not have a star on it or near it that could be dubbed Pliocene Polaris. He would center the cross-sight anew on this point in the sky and try to verify the pole's position before dawn, with a 2-hour shot. Failing that, he would check it tomorrow night with a good long time interval for maximum rotation. Richard set his wrist chronometer's alarm for 0300, glad that he hadn't followed the impulse to throw the thing away, back in Madame Gudrian's rose garden on that rainy morning when he had abandoned his universe. Less than 20 hours ago. 10. Even though he had been partially briefed by Crayon on what to expect, Brian found the reality of the riverside city of Renaya nearly overwhelming. The party of riders came suddenly upon the place after wending their way through a dark canyon where the guards' torches barely illuminated a narrow trail cut in buff sandstone. The caravan emerged onto a knoll overlooking the confluence of the Saône and the Rhône, and saw the town below on the west bank, just south of the snout of forested crags where the two great rivers joined. Rania was built on a rise adjacent to the water. Twisting around the hill's base was an earthen rampart crowned by a thick fortified wall. All along the top of this, glittering like lavish strings of orange beads, were closely spaced little fires. High square watchtowers jutted out from the wall every 100 meters or so, and these too were outlined in pricks of fire all along their crenellated battlements around the windows and even up and down the corners and angles of the walls. A massive city gate had almost every detail of its architecture picked out in small lamps. Leading to the gate was a colonnaded avenue, half a kilometer long, every column of which was capped with a huge flaming torch. The midway was flanked with spangled geometrical patterns that might have been lamp-bordered lawns or flower beds planted in parterre designs. From the caravan's vantage point above the town, Brian could see that Rania was uncrowded. It's mostly small houses laid out along wide, curving streets. Since it was well past midnight, most of the dwellings showed no window lights, but along the edges of the roofs were little dots of fire, and the parapets that fronted the houses were also illuminated by thousands of the evenly spaced lamps. Closer to the riverside were a number of larger structures bearing slender towers of varying heights. The walls and major features of these buildings were outlined in light as elaborately as the city gate was, but instead of oil lamp orange, the facades glowed with blue, bright green, aquamarine, and amber. Many of the towers had their windows ablaze.
"It's like fairyland," breathed Suki. "All those little sparkling lights?"
"Each inhabitant is obligated to contribute to urban illumination by maintaining the lamps of his own house," Cran said. "The common fuel is olive oil, which is extremely plentiful. The taller Tanu dwellings are lit by more sophisticated lamps, energized by accumulations of surplus metapsychic emanations."
They rode down, following the track until it merged with a road paved in granite sets that widened to nearly 80 meters as it approached the avenue of fire-topped columns. Between the great pillars stood neat frameworks of bamboo arranged in aisles, separated by dark shrubbery and clusters of palm trees. Crane explained that booths for a market were set up in this exterior garden every month, featuring the goods of local artisans as well as luxury products of all kinds brought in by caravans. Once a year, there was also a great fair, which attracted people from all over Western Europe.
"You have no daily market for foods, then?" Brian asked. "Meat is the great diet staple," Crayon replied. "Professional hunters, all human, bring in large quantities of game to the plantations in the more northerly reaches of both the Saône and Rhône. It is sent downstream daily to the town provisioners on barges, together with grain, fruit, and other produce from the farm, such as olive oil and wine. Most of the food processing is done at the plantations by Rama workers. In years gone by, our own people supervised the plantations. Now, almost all of them are overseen by humans."
"And you see no potential hazard in such an arrangement?" Brian asked.
Crane smiled, the flickering lights striking sparks from his deep-set eyes. "No hazard at all. The humans engaged in critical occupations all wear the torque. But try to understand that coercion is seldom necessary. For all but the most deeply disturbed of your people, the world of exile is a happy one."
"Even for the women?" Elizabeth inquired.
The unperturbed Tanu said,
"Even the lowliest non-meta women of the commonality are completely free from drudgery. They may engage in the occupations of their choice, or live in indolence. They may even pleasure themselves as they will with human lovers. The only restriction is that their children must be by us."
The more fortunate humans possessing genetic codons for metafunction enjoyed a privileged position.
"They are welcomed into our society as probationary equals. In the fullness of time, Those who have proved their loyalty to the Tanu may exchange their silver torques for gold.
Both men and women? Aiken asked, his lips twitching.
Both men and women. I'm sure you can appreciate our reproductive strategy. We not only strengthen our line against the effects of the local radiation, but also incorporate your genes for latent and operant metability. Ultimately, we may hope to evolve fully operant metapsychics.
He nodded at Elizabeth.
Even as you will have done 6 million years from now, we will then be freed from the limitation of the golden torques.
Elizabeth said, Quite a grand design. How do you reconcile it with the reality of this planet's future, with no Tanu?
Bran smiled. The goddess wreaks as she wills. 6 million years is a long time. I think we Tanu will be grateful to settle for a small portion of it to call our own.
They approached closer to the great gate, which was 12 or 13 meters wide and almost twice as high, fashioned of titanic balks of timber heavily reinforced with bronze plates.
Not much action outside here at night, is there?
Aiken commented.
There are wild animals and other dangers, Cran said. The night is not a time for humans to be abroad, unless they are going about the business of the Tanu.
Interesting, Brian said. These city walls and the rampart must be effective against almost any kind of night prowlers. They're certainly over-elaborate as a protection from animal menaces, or even aggression from outlaw humans. And I understand there are some here and there.
Oh, yes, Cran admitted, with a dismissing wave of his hand. Little more than a minor nuisance.
Then what purpose do the fortifications really serve?
There are always, Cran said, the Firvalok.
They came to a halt immediately in front of the gate. Above its arch was the same golden mask emblem that had adorned the entrance to Castle Gateway. Captain Zdenek, accompanied by one torch-bearing soldier, rode to a shadowed niche and detached a stout chain that dangled from the soffit of the overhanging archway. The chain had a ball of metal-caged stone on the end that measured a good half-meter in diameter. Zdenek rode out a short distance holding the ball, and then turned, took aim, and let it swing back toward the gate in a pendulum arc. It struck a blackened bronze lens set into the timbered valve, and there was a deep-throated boom, as from a huge old-world church bell. Even as the soldier caught the returning ball and put it back into its niche, the ponderous gate began to swing open. Cran rode forward alone, rising above the saddle to his full height, so that his scarlet and white robes streamed back in the breeze rushing from the widening aperture. He cried out 3 words in an exotic tongue, simultaneously transmitting a complex mental image that the torque-wearing humans and Elizabeth were unable to decipher. 2 squads of human soldiers with crested helmets stood at attention on either side of the open entrance. The engraved plates and scales on their ceremonial bronze armor gleamed like gold in the light of countless flaming lamps. Beyond the gate, lining the otherwise deserted street for almost an entire block on both sides, were the Ramas. Each small ape wore a metal collar and a blue and gold tabard. Each held a wand of some glassy material, tipped with a blue or an amber light. Cran and his retinue passed between the ranks of Ramapithecines, and the little animals turned and pattered alongside the Chalicos, escorting the riders through the streets of the sleeping town. At one plaza, where the waters of a large fountain splashed onto floating lanterns, Captain Zdenek saluted Cran and rode off toward a dim barracks with the soldiers Billy and Sengkyu, their night's work at an end. The timefarers gaped at the houses, dark except for the myriad twinkling oil lamps along every roof gutter, garden wall, and balustrade. Exile architecture in the human quarter was a melange of mortared stonework, half-timbering, and quasi-biblical mud plaster, with thick walls for coolness, tiled roofs, vine-hung loggias, deep in shadow,
and small patios planted with palms, laurels, and aromatic cinnamon trees.
Munchkin tutor, Brian decided. Humanity had retained its sense of humor in spite of the 6-million-year banishment.
They saw no people at all, but here and there other child-sized Ramas, wearing tabards of differing colors, went about mysterious errands, pushing little covered carts. Once, in an oddly reassuring incident, an unmistakable Siamese cat streaked across the main avenue and disappeared into the open window of a house. The Chalico riders neared a complex of larger buildings close to the river. These were constructed of material resembling white marble and set off from the rest of the town by an ornamental wall breached at intervals by wide stairways. The parapet at the top was decorated with planter urns, spilling flowers. In place of the homely town lamps of ceramic or metal fretwork, torchères like great silver candlesticks lit the precincts of the Tanu. The dwellings were hung with chains of faceted glass lanterns, their blue, green, and amber making an eerie contrast to the friendly warmth of the oil lamps on the streets of the outer town. There were a few familiar touches, water lilies in tiled pools, climbing yellow roses supported on delicate trellises of marble filigree, a nightingale, wakened by the sound of their passage that uttered a few sleepy notes. They passed into a courtyard hemmed by ornate frosty buildings. Here a large door was suddenly flung open, and golden radiance streamed forth, catching them by surprise. As the Ramas stood solemnly by, human servitors came rushing out to take the bridles of the Chalicos, unlock the ankle chains of the prisoners, and help them to dismount. Then came the Tanu, 20 or 30 of them, laughing and calling out greetings to Crayon in the exotic tongue and chattering in animated exuberance over the time travelers in musical standard English. The Tanu wore thin flowing gowns and robes of vivid tropical colors, together with fantastic jewelry. Wide yoke collars all gemmed and enameled, with brocaded and jeweled ribbons dangling front and rear. The women had wired headdresses, all hung with gemstones. Here and there, among the lofty exotics, were a few smaller human figures just as gaudily dressed, but wearing silver torques instead of the Tanu gold. Brian studied these privileged humans with interest. They seemed to be socially integrated with the taller ruling race, and just as anxious to make the acquaintance of the overawed prisoners. Among the arrivals, only Aiken was completely at ease. With his pocketed suit flashing like liquid metal, he fairly hopped about the courtyard, making mocking obeisance to the laughing Tanu ladies, most of whom were nearly a third taller than he was. Brian stood apart from the others and watched. The Tanu nobles were solicitous of the comfort of the prisoners, joking over the incongruity of the situation, somehow managing to make the newly met exiles feel wanted and welcome. Brian had no doubt that mental speech was flying about as fervidly as the vocal sort. He wondered what kind of psychic stimulant might be operating at the lower levels of consciousness to make even sullen Ramo and the aloof Elizabeth slowly unbend and join in the conviviality.
"We don't want you to feel left out, Brian."
The anthropologist turned and saw a slender exotic male, garbed in a simple blue robe, smiling at him. He had a handsome but sunken-eyed visage, lined about the mouth as Crayon's was. Brian wondered whether this might be a sign of extreme age among these inhumanly youthful-looking people. The man's hair was of the palest ivory, and he wore a narrow coronet of a material resembling blue glass.
"Permit me to welcome you. I am your host, Bormal, like yourself a student of culture. How eagerly we have awaited the arrival of another trained analyst. The last anthropologist who came to us arrived nearly 30 years ago, and he was unfortunately in frail health. And we need your insights so urgently. We have so much to learn about the interaction of our two races if this exile society is to flourish to our mutual advantage. The science of your galactic milieu can teach us the things we must know in order to survive. Come, we have good food and drink waiting for you, and your friends inside.
Share with us some of your first impressions of our many-colored land. Give us your initial reactions.
Brian managed a rueful laugh.
You flatter me, Lord Bormal, and overwhelm me. I'm damned if I can make head or tail of your world as yet. After all, I've only just arrived, and excuse me, but I'm so tired out after this bloody shocking day that I'm ready to drop in my tracks.
Forgive me, I'd completely forgotten you're without a torque. The mental refreshment that our people have been lavishing over your companions hasn't affected you. If you wish, we can...
No, thank you.
Grant came up and smiled ironically at the anthropologist's sudden alarm.
Brian would prefer to do his work without the consolations of the torque. In fact, he has made this a condition of cooperation.
You don't have to coerce me, Brian said testily.
Don't misunderstand.
Bormal appeared pained. He gestured at the gaudy throng, now leading the other prisoners inside with every evidence of good fellowship.
Are your friends being coerced? The torque isn't a symbol of bondage, but of union.
Brian felt a surge of anger and dreadful weariness erupt in him. His voice remained calm.
I know you mean well, but there are many of us humans. One might say most of us in my world of the future, most of the normal members of humanity, who would rather die than submit to your torque, in spite of all its consolations. Now you must excuse me. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I'm not up to any learned discussions right now. I'd like to go to bed.
Bormal bowed his head. One of the human servants came running up with Brian's pack.
We will meet again in the capital. I hope you will have modified your harsh opinion of us by then, Brian.
This is Joe Don, who will take you to a retiring room at once. Rest well. Bormal and Crayon glided away. Almost everyone else had already left the courtyard.
Right this way, sir,
Joe Don said, his breezy aplomb equal to that of a bellman in one of the old world's posher hostelries.
We've got a nice room ready for you, but too bad you'll miss the party.
They went off into corridors decorated in blue and gold and white. Brian caught a glimpse of the unconscious Stein being borne away on a litter by four more human attendants.